The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Ben Burgess returns this week as we discuss Hegel's logic and Hegel's critique of gradualism, and whether or not Charlie Brown is bald. It's Thursday, January 10th, 2019, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're a patron of the Zero Books podcast and you're listening to the Patreon feed, you're about to hear a two-hour conversation. If you're listening to this podcast through the Podomatic or Blueberry feeds, then what you're about to hear is a 20-minute teaser. If you want to hear the rest, then subscribe to the podcast through Patreon. Patreon subscribers get access to two podcasts every week, Symptomatic Redness and Zero Squared. If you're listening for free, you'll be able to access one or the other podcast every week. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Linus and Lucy, which is the Charlie Brown theme. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Ben Burgess gradually discuss Hegel, gradualism, and revolution. So last time we spoke, you and I were kind of discussed Hegel and Aristotle a little bit, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And I thought we might start there, then jump into a bit of Hegel on measure, and then also from there talk about revolution and the different approaches to revolution that we've discovered that we hold by talking and fighting on Facebook, which is always the best way to start a dispute. So
yeah, it's the most productive and the most likely to lead to the truth.
Right, exactly. But actually, it was a fine conversation, and I am looking forward to talking about it again now. To start with, though, why don't we be a little bit general about the difference between Aristotelian logic and dialectical logic or Hegelian logic? I'm not an expert on Hegel's logic. I mean, I haven't read The Science of Logic. I've read The Phenomenology. So I feel as though I have an impression of Hegel's method from having read that, but I don't have it spelled out as an actual method.
I think logic, in the sense that you learn about if you take a logic class, whether a symbolic logic class or the kind of more informal logic class that some universities might call like a critical reasoning class, where you learn about logical fallacies and things like that. So that kind of logic is one thing. And, you know, it's what we, you know, could refer to as Aristotelian logic, although honestly, I mean, I think that's even a little like, you know, I'm slightly, you know, resistant to that that word, because it's a little bit like, say, you know, it's a little bit like say that anybody who believes that there's an objective external world is a Cartesian, right? You know, because Descartes talked about, you know, giving arguments for the existence of an objective external world. I think sort of basic logical principles, you know, Aristotle gave a couple of big ones, their proper names, and there's been lots of progress in logic, you know, since then. But, you know, if we want to just use Aristotelian logic as a label for logic in that sense, that's fine with me. And then what's sometimes called Hegelian logic, because Hegel himself, you know, sometimes talks like that, and Marx and Engels sometimes talk like that, although not that much actually. I think is just a completely different beast. And when I say it's a completely different beast, I mean it's not that these are two theories of one subject matter. That that there's like the Aristotelian theory of logic and a Hegelian theory of logic. These are theories of different subjects. So logic, in the sense that we identified as Aristotelian, is the study of arguments. So in particular, it's the study of when two statements can both be true, whether they contradict each other, whether if you accept all the premises of some argument but you don't accept the conclusion, you're contradicting yourself, whether there's some weaker sense than that in which the premises of an argument give support to the conclusion. And that's one sense of logic. So that's what logic means there. I think, honestly, to me, I think it's less confusing if we just call, the Hegelian, what's sometimes called Hegelian logic, dialectical methodology, or the dialectical method.
I'll just call it dialectics, maybe.
Dialectics, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I think that what dialectics it really is a certain kind of analytic method where you're interested in like counterposed forces or impulses, I'm being vague here because I think you have to be vague to encompass everything that Hegel talks about and also everything that Marx talks about. But I think it gets a little bit more concrete when you start going through specific terms. Like, so part of what's confusing about this is that a lot of the same words are used in both contexts, but I think you don't have to scratch very far below the surface to see that they're being used in different ways. So, contradiction is one of them. Negation is one of them. But in the sort of contradictions that we're interested in when we're interested in logic in the sense that we call it Aristotelian, the logic class sense of logic, are contradictions in the sense of two statements that contradict each other, two statements that can't both be true and that you can just by looking at the formal features of them, you see that they can't both be true. So if I say that we're talking on Skype right now and we're not talking on Skype right now, that's a logical contradiction. But once you get to Marx and Engels, where you use contradiction to talk about things like the contradiction between different classes, and if you see that as some sort of thesis about logic in the sense of looking at the logical relationship between statements, then that's just mystifying, right? What does that mean? There's a logical contradiction between the working class and the capitalist class. So what I take contradiction in the Hegelian sense to mean is something like a situation where there are aspects of the situation that are pulling in different directions, in such a way that the kind of tension between them sort of leads to new developments or new possibilities later on down the line. And I think that a lot of times what Marx and Engels and later Marxists really seem to have gotten out of Hegel's method is almost – you can almost think of as a sort of set of values for how we go about trying to analyze – well, the things that dialectical materialists are interested in analyzing, which are – societies, social forces, social classes, things, the sort of dynamics of situations where instead of looking at, small parts of it in isolation from the larger picture, you try to look at the whole and you see what the dynamic forces are that, what are the, what are the sort of wellsprings that are, moving this whole thing forward? What's the, what is it? What are the, the sort of points in which something that looks very stable has these conflicted impulses within it that might make it unstable. And I think that, you know, look, I mean, there's a way.
Can I jump in with a little addition or addendum on that?
Yeah.
Well, one thing to keep in mind with Hegel is that he is coming after Kant in two senses. One is he's critiquing Kant, and the other is that he's following, you know, in the footsteps of Kant. He is interested in understanding rather than approaching the world as an objective reality to be defined and described. He is approaching the world as a subjective reality to be understood. And so one of the things he notices is how concepts or perceptions even rely on what I'll just call a negation in order to take form. So just put it really simply, if you can't distinguish between what is and what is not, or like what is a basketball and what is not a basketball, you won't be able to hold on to the concept of basketball. That you have to have a negation in order to have the concept. So this is a kind of the most elementary level of the contradiction, the kind of contradiction, or really the negation that I think Hegel points to.
Yeah. So when we were talking about this on the last time I was on, the example you gave me was of a Hegelian contradiction from Hegel was the way that when you make a law or a sort of moral norm against something, you're creating the opposite of it, which is the sort of category of violating that law. If you can walk on the grass, even though there's no sign saying walk on the grass, but you can't violate property rights, without there being some property claim that might be signified by that sign, and that one, and maybe I'm just focusing on it because I've had some time to think about that, and I'm less sure I understand the basketball example. But that one seems like a really nice illustration of, it's a good Hegel example because it's all on this conceptual, ideal, conceptual level. He's an idealist. He's not a materialist, it's a very suggestive kind of example, both in a it almost sounds like something that you could imagine being quoted at the beginning of a, Dostoevsky novel or something, that they, when we have the norm, we have the possibility of the violation of the norm. But it also gives you, I think, a good sense philosophically of what he's up to there, because of course there's no logical inconsistency between the existence of a norm and the existence of a violation of the norm, which isn't an objection to Hegel, or at least it's not an objection to Hegel if you don't think that's what he's up to, right? If you think that what he's up to is that he's interested in the interplay of different elements of a situation that are pulling in contrary directions or something like that. Even if he's interested in that on the level of ideas and not on the level of a objective material reality.
Right. Another example would be maybe the distinction between a subject and an object. In order for there to be a subject position, and this is, I think, an important one, there has to be something alienated from the subject that is taken to be not the subject, but an object for the subject. That's another kind of, Hegelian observation about the nature of perception. And it, I think, comes out of his engagement with Kant. The question of how do we relate to the world of objects? How do we find the divide between our own subjective experience and some sort of noumenal reality is one that's kind of plaguing philosophers in that. So Hegel's entering into this terrain and trying to not only solve it in a Kantian way, but then also to be able to hold on to something like pure reason. In other words, to regain access to a transcendent reality by understanding the structure of our thought rather than the content of our thought or the, I mean, he was actually sort of doing an immanent critique of Kant because he's saying, look, you've already discovered pure reason or some sort of absolute in your own work, which Kant wants to get away from. So all this is maybe to the side of where we're headed, but I think it's not entirely to the side of it because there's an idealist component to Hegelian thought. Obviously, he's an idealist. He's a German idealist, which means that he's focused on concepts and how they relate to each other rather than, like a Marxist would be, material conditions. And so this is a problem for people who want to be hard-headed and engage in the world objectively or materially. It leads to problems that might inform our politics. I'm not sure if I'm making this transition too quickly, but I do think we could possibly start to talk about this question about gradualness or the difference between quality and quantity.
Yeah, so I wonder if it might be useful to just kind of spend a minute talking about kind of how we got there in the first place. Because this is and this actually might be depending on what you make of all of this, this might be an interesting intersection point between the two senses of logic that we started out with. Because I think you first brought this up to me after I was on Michael Brooks's show. He does these illicit history things. I did an illicit history of logic for him, and in there we listened to a clip from everybody's favorite logician, Ben Shapiro, and in the Shapiro clip, he's pushing hard on the immorality of abortion, but by raising these questions about when exactly a fetus becomes a person, and he in his inimitable style, he rattles off talking very quickly, like 20 different points in the pregnancy. Is it this? Is it this? Is it this? And the structure of the argument seems to be to invite the listener to conclude that there's just no non-arbitrary cutoff point. And then to resolve that by just saying the fetus is always a person, and I did my thing, you know, as somebody who wants to reclaim logic in that first Aristotelian sense for the left, and said, hold on, the other Ben is committing a logical fallacy here. So he's committed the continuum fallacy. So the continuum fallacy is the mistake that we make in reasoning when we go from the lack of a clear, obvious cutoff point to the conclusion that there just is no distinction, right? So and this comes out of a very, very old philosophical problem going back to the ancient Greeks, the Sorites paradox, where the classic example is like, you know, two grains of sand isn't a heap of sand. And okay, it doesn't look like if you just add one grain of sand to something that's not a heap of sand, that's going to become a heap of sand. But you keep on adding grains and adding grains and adding grains, and eventually you're going to get a heap of sand. Or you could do it with baldness. That's another classic example. If you, if you start out like, you know, with, you know, somebody like you or me with a nice full head of hair, and take off one hair, that's clearly not going to make you bald. It doesn't seem like the difference between baldness and non-baldness should be one hair, but you keep on taking off a hair, and there's no clear, sharp cutoff point, but eventually you're going to be bald. So in There are lots of like really interesting, tricky, unresolved philosophical issues about this. But one thing that does seem like a relatively clear lesson is that you can't just go from the lack of a sharp cutoff point between A and B, or at the very least, you can't go from the lack of a clear, epistemically available sharp cutoff point between A and B to the conclusion that there's no distinction between A and B. You know, that like if you imagine just a series of slides, right, starting with you with the hair that you have right now, and, you know, each one has one less hair, it's not like, you know, you'd be able to identify when it came to like, oh, there's the one, right? Like, you know, there's the – because, you know, there's the one at which if I have one less hair than this, I'm bald because, you know, we don't generally the way we use the word bald, it's a vague term like heap. We don't – you know, we don't mean you have literally zero hairs. If somebody has zero hairs and we add one hair, we don't say they're, you know, they're no longer bald. So there's no place in the progression where you'd really stop and say, oh, aha, you know, here's where,
it does raise an interesting question though.
Yeah.
Is, for instance, is Charlie Brown bald or not? He had that one hair on the, anyway, go ahead.
You know, my wife really likes the Peanuts. I've been exposed to a lot of Peanuts related content in these last several years, and I really don't think they ever get into it, like why this small child is bald.
I think it's anything to make him more pathetic is the move.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Back to
Yeah, yeah. So I brought up this example –